This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The first thing is, all of this is alleged. Nothing has been substantiated. This person has not come out publicly.
Rebecca Schumann is deep in academia, an adjunct professor at the University of St. Louis, contributing writer to the Chronicle of Higher Ed, and an education columnist for Slate. Here she is talking about a teaching job negotiation gone awry.
So this is a story that appeared on the very widely read philosophy blog called The Philosophy Smoker. And what happened was an individual had received an offer from a small liberal arts college in upstate New York to join the philosophy department. And she was very excited about it. And so she wrote back with a counteroffer that, you know, it was asking big. She asked big. She wanted a lower teaching load than an institution like that could ever give her. She wanted more money. She wanted the maternity leave policy of the department to be in writing instead of quote unquote informal. She wanted a sabbatical. You know, she thought it was the opening move in a series of negotiations. But what happened instead was that she got a one paragraph email back saying, we've looked at what you want. We've decided it's not appropriate for a school like this, which is more teaching centered. You sound like you want to work at a university that is a research university. We're going to pull the offer. We wish you the best of luck. And this just blindsided her. She was not, because she thought an offer is an offer and the worst they can do is say no. But instead, the worst they could do was just pull that offer altogether. And the reaction within academia, instead of supporting this person who thought that she had an offer and then had it pulled, was to say, how dare she try to ask for those things? The school was right to do it. And so what struck me as amazing wasn't just the fact that the school did have a lot of other people to choose from and basically just dropped her like a hot potato. It was that the rest of academia was completely on board with this buyer's market mentality and is completely okay with offers not being final and the idea of negotiation being, how do I put it, negotiation being another part of the job interview. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, she could have asked for a golf jet and a pony. And the worst that they should have said was, nope, that's a deal breaker. And you seem to be asking a little high. Let's talk on the phone.
That's what Word of Mouth is talking about today, jobs. Let's start with the most difficult part of any gig, landing it. Rebecca's secondhand story got so much response and traction online because for many people, it became a kind of allegory for the post-recession job market. You've probably heard some variation of it. You're lucky to have a job. Stop complaining. Career consultant Maggie Mistel has another take on the climate for getting and negotiating a job. Maggie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Virginia. Happy to be here.
So what's your thought after hearing that story?
You know, I don't think taking sides is the answer. And unfortunately, I think that's the direction that the story went in. I think it's a good opportunity to have a conversation about what kinds of conversations can we have when we have a job offer on the table, and how to conduct those conversations. Because the number one red flag, as I listened to that, Virginia, is that she did this via email. Email has no tone to it. And I don't know about you, but in the times in my career when I've been misunderstood or taken the wrong way, it's been when I've sent an email, not when I've had a conversation. Even over the phone, you can be more clear.
Even if that conversation had happened in person, is it common for a job offer to be rescinded?
It can happen. I've heard of it happening. It's not that strange for an employer to say, oh, we thought we were going to get something else. I don't think there's anything that dramatic about the offer being rescinded. I just think this person thought there would be more conversation. And again, I just think she was taken the wrong way.
How about the state of negotiation in general right now, Maggie? Career Builder conducted a study recently and found that only 40% of job candidates even try to negotiate job offers. What is it that holds people back?
Well, I'd say that's the worst outcome from this story, because I can see a lot of people saying, oh, I better not negotiate. Mm. That's a bad thing.
Right. I think people do have a sense that right now you're lucky to have a job. You're lucky to have an offer. Is this something that happens in a post-recession economy?
I think it's what happens when people are scared and when they buy into a philosophy that says, I'm not that valuable. And the mindset issue that I'm often coaching my clients through is this one that says, well, what is your unique value? Because everyone does have what I have found, Virginia. Each one of us is uniquely built in such a way to have certain preferences, certain talents. We have certain experiences that other people don't possess. But what we often do is take that for granted. Something comes so easily for us, we think it must come easily for everyone. And that's not the case. And when you look at the job satisfaction results, which is what I look to, which says, are you happy in your job? People are bored. People are unhappy. I mean, we have lower and lower job satisfaction numbers every year. So to me, this salary negotiation is like the tip of an iceberg that says, here's a symptom of a larger problem where people and organizations are not looking at where the fit is. We're too worried about finding the person with the exact resume rather than giving somebody a chance who's maybe a career changer who does have, though, a natural talent in a new field that maybe they hadn't made their career, but they've come to realize is what they're here to do.
And will those people who do advocate for themselves in the beginning, in that initial conversation and negotiation, are they perceived as stronger and are they more likely to make more money over the rest of their career?
Absolutely. I mean, in general, when you're the kind of person who has thought through and soul-searched to figure out, here's what I'm here to do, here's what I know I'm best at, and here, employer, is why I'm sitting in this chair talking to you at this stage in my career for this job, right? So when people get that kind of clarity, employers are like, yeah, what do you need to work here? Because employers don't have the time and energy to train someone into a job and get them excited about it. They'd love to. They think that's nice, but they don't feel they have the luxury of time to do that. They need people who can jump in and hit the ground running. And when you're that kind of person that says, here's why this is the job that I'm the best fit for, and specific about the things that they do well that that company needs them to do, yeah, the negotiations are much easier. Because companies are like, great, you're doing the work for us. You're almost recruiting for us because you're coming to us proactively as a target company. It's what more employees and more job seekers need to do.
Maggie, how about if you are somebody who doesn't have a Maggie Mistel career consultant with them, any advice on getting people started on this road to figure out where their passion, purpose, their sense of empowerment begins?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say a lot of the job seekers we're talking about are experienced job seekers. They're the ones who, folks over 50. The great news, I love working with people over 50, is that they have so much work experience in that they know what they're great at, and they've had moments. Even if they haven't had careers that they've loved, they've had moments that they've loved. And these times of ecstatic engagement, when they found a project to be purposeful and fun, and it came easily to them, and it was a big success, those are the moments to latch onto, right? So look back over your career and look to replicate more of those. Look to expand on more of those. And so that may be going back to the nonprofit that you helped and pitching to do more of that project because it shined and it worked. You want to expand on those moments when things worked, because I know for every single person listening, whether they're employed or not employed, there were moments that were better than others in their careers. And you want to expand on those better moments because that's what leads to opportunity, no matter what the economy is doing.
Maggie Mistel, thank you for the positive spin.
It's not just a spin, Virginia. It's the truth. You just got to believe it.
Maggie Mistel, career consultant and executive coach. You can find a link to her negotiating tips at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Many people dream of working from home. No boss, you get to make your own schedule, you can work in your pajamas. When Word of Mouth continues, the not-so-dreamy realities of freelance life. We'll talk to a writer for hire about the hustle of juggling jobs. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
From NHPR, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
It's a freelance life for us. It's a freelance life for us.
Steady paycheck.
Yeah, get real.
Chips for dinner.
That's a meal. It's a freelance life.
That's the comedy troupe Garlic Jackson performing Freelance Life, a parody of the mixed bag of freedom and uncertainty that freelancing affords.
Being your own boss and choosing what you work on hardly sounds like a hard-knock life, but freelancing is not always a choice, and it's on the rise in the U.S. The Freelancers Union counts 1 in 3 American workers as independents. Other sources predict that by 2020, 50% of the American workforce will be freelancers. Nicole Deeker is. She's a freelance writer who covers freelance life for Billfold.com. Each month, she posts about her jobs and how much she earned, and she's going to give us a little peek inside the life of a freelance writer. Nicole, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
You write very candidly about how much money you make, which jobs you get. So let's have the breakdown, if we could, for March. How'd you do?
So for March, I completed 119 separate pieces for clients. And these pieces include anything from long-form essays, like 1,500 words, or very short advertising copy pieces, like the sort of piece you might see in catalog copy. So I did 119 separate pieces. I earned $3,583.39.
At the risk of sounding like someone's mother, is that enough to live on?
It is for now. I am still relatively young. I live in a studio apartment. I have very few expenses. And I, you know, if I can pay my own way, I'm earning enough for now.
And you're in Seattle, right?
I am in Seattle.
So I imagine there are slimmer months and fatter months.
There are definitely slimmer months and fatter months. February was a slimmer month. I don't believe I broke $2,000 in February, but usually I earn between $3,000 and $3,500.
Yeah, I'm looking at $1,911.76 for February.
Yes.
So have you figured out what your typical monthly or annual salary is?
Last year, my annual salary was around $31,000 of taxable income. Mm-hmm. This year, I am hoping to beat $38,000, which is, from what I understand, the United States government's designation of middle income for a single person. Be pretty sweet.
Well, I imagine you have a lot of things to write off as a freelancer, don't you?
As a freelance writer, you don't, actually. You very rarely, for example, take business lunches. You can't properly write off your computer and your home office unless you spend 100% of your time freelancing. So if I watch Netflix on my laptop, I can't write it off. Or I could buy 2 laptops, but I didn't do that.
Okay, well, there goes another myth blown of the freelancer. Let's talk about the real day, or a typical day. Do you have a typical day, or what does that look like?
I do. I try to work from about 9 in the morning until 7 in the evening, with usually a decent-sized dinner break in there. I used to try to complete 5,000 words a day, and then my pay rates got raised, which meant I only had to complete 3,000 words a day, which actually makes the name a lot nicer. But it's pretty much you wake up, you read the news so you know what's important, you know, and then you open up your list of assignments and you start writing whatever they are.
Tell us a little bit about the variety of that list of assignments. When I was reading up on you, I see my name is Nicole Deeker. I'm 32 years old and I am one of the unsung invisible hacks of the internet generation.
Yes.
What are you writing?
I'm writing everything. The internet is full of, I mean, it's called content. That's the technical term for it. But it's really full of words, you know. Every day, there are words everywhere. There are advertising words. All of those emails you get, you know, some of those email campaigns, I write those. Some of those listicles that you see, like clickbait listicles, you know, the 10 best ways to do something or the 10 best celebrity wedding dresses, right? I write those things. I've written text for web pages. So if someone is starting a business and they need a web page created, I will write the copy that will go on that web page. All kinds of things.
Well, I imagine you have to become sort of an expert on things very quickly.
You really do. It's really fascinating.
It's also a little disturbing, I have to say. You know, as a reader and a consumer of content, knowing that people are just kind of adapting and churning on a daily basis. I mean, make a case for me why that works.
I actually think that's sort of how it's always been. I mean, certainly in terms of freelancers who've, you know, if you think back to Mad Men, for example, they write on all different kinds of products every day, right? The copywriters who worked in the advertising industry, mm-hmm. you know, and you have a very little bit of knowledge. You may not be an expert in the content area, but you have enough to complete the message that the client is asking you to put forward.
Since the listicle is kind of the language of the internet, I wonder if you can give me your listicle on five reasons why being a freelancer works.
Five reasons why being a freelancer works.
Is five the right number, by the way, Nicole, or do you always go for 10?
Actually, the popular number is 7 for whatever reason. It's like, you know, when you ask people to pick a number between 1 and 10, and they always pick 7. So it's 7, it's 17, it's like 22. Round numbers don't do as well as non-round numbers. But I'll give you five reasons why being a freelance writer works, with some caveats. Being a freelance writer works, first of all, if you are willing to work. This is not a job for the procrastinator. You know, if you've got a certain number of words to churn out, you have to sit down and write them. In many ways, it's like taking the SAT every single day. So, and being a freelance writer also works if you are, you know, willing to be a bit frugal with your life. Certainly, I mean, it's astonishing that I earn more money than a lot of people. But you also have to be sort of creative and not, you know, thrift stores are your friends and all that. So number three reason why freelance writing works is because there is such a demand for content right now. Like I said, the internet requires, you know, hundreds of thousands of new words every day. They don't want to use yesterday's words. They want new ones for search engine reasons and to capture attention. And because websites need, you know, every website now has 10 new articles a day. Where are they getting that? They're getting that from people like me. That's number three.
You don't have to do 7. Right. You can do as many as works.
How about that? We'll stop at 3.
All right. If you're getting paid per piece, you just did 3. Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder about that, Nicole. Do you worry about dispersing your energy on these little pieces? You know, say you're writing 5,000 words a day. If you were putting 5,000 words a day into serious articles rather than, you know, a little piece for this here, a little piece for that there, a little piece for that there, would that be more satisfying, more of a career path you want to take, or are you happy working with it the way it is?
I think that, you know, there's always an element, and this is true of every career, not just of freelancing. There's the stuff you do for money, and there's the stuff you do because it's interesting or because it will further your career or because you will want to do it. You know, it would be certainly lovely if the only thing I ever did was write 2,000 word essays on topics I loved and knew everything about, but that is not the reality of the business at all. So you balance the pieces you really want to do with the pieces that people are going to pay you to do. So I don't feel like my work on advertising and copywriting is taking away from, you know, my ability to write more long form essays. It's sort of like the supply and demand thing. The demand for my personal essays is just not as high as the demand for me writing email campaigns, for example.
Nicole Dieker is a freelance writer who writes about the freelance lifestyle for Billfold.com, among other places. Nicole, it strikes me that you get paid for the Billfold column, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So that's a pretty consistent paycheck for you, writing about freelance paychecks.
It is, yes. It is only, I mean, it's every piece is only a fraction of the total pay. So you have to write a lot of pieces to get the sort of paycheck that I do.
Well, I wonder if not having a steady job and steady paycheck has a kind of uncertainty and a stress. You're always thinking about freelancers that I know are always thinking what's happening 2 months from now. Does that weigh on you?
It does and it doesn't. I've very much learned to live with it. This is sort of the second year that I've been doing this. So, you know, it does, but I also know how to deal with it. I know how to hustle, you know, and once you learn how to really hustle, you're able to find something out there.
So you must have to pitch a lot of ideas, right?
I do. I pitch all the time.
So how do you deal with rejection?
It's rejection. Who cares, basically.
How about competition? I wonder about how many other friends, you know, people of your cohort, as they say, are also freelancing. Are you all going for the same kind of jobs?
We are. But the great thing about these kind of jobs is that they're not exactly infinite, but they feel like they are. For example, if I wanted to place an article on, you know, a major site, if I wanted to place an article on The Atlantic or BuzzFeed or Slate, it's not like there's only one article they'll ever need. They need, you know, 15 articles a day. So there's plenty of room for everyone.
Well, then, of course, there is health insurance. If you want it, you have to get it for yourself.
Absolutely.
I'm wondering how that's worked for you. Has the Affordable Care Act actually played a role in your decisions about your career or your insurance needs?
I had self-employed insurance prior to the Affordable Care Act. And then when the Affordable Care Act launched, I was very excited to learn about the opportunities available to me. And then the website was broken, so I couldn't take advantage of it. So maybe
they need to hire you to write an apology on their website.
I've heard it's working now, and I haven't checked it recently. But before the January 31 deadline, I just stuck with self-employed health insurance because I couldn't get the site to work.
Well, from what we're told, if you started the process, you can go back there. You're still covered.
I'm excited to do that. I should actually put that on my to-do list to look at it again.
You must have a pretty good size to-do list.
I have an enormous to-do list.
Well, I thank you for taking the time with us today.
Thank you. It was very lovely.
Nicole Deeker, freelance writer who writes about the freelance lifestyle, among many, many other things. You can find a link to read her blog at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to head into the corporate office and find out what lies beneath the income gap between men and women. First, the news from NHPR.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and today's show is all about work. We just talked about some of the panic and the freedoms of being a freelancer. Now we move on up to corporate life and the corner office. In 1999, director Mike Judge released Office Space, which has earned cult status as a satire of the daily bludgeoning of life inside a cubicle. Here's the film's protagonist, Peter Gibbons, meeting with two consultants dispatched to downsize his company.
Would you walk us through a typical day?
Well, I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. I use the side door. That way Lumberg can't see me. and after that, I just sort of space out for about an hour.
Space out?
Yeah. I just stare at my desk. But it looks like I'm working. I do that for probably another hour after lunch, too. I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Okay, spoiler alert. The disgruntled Peter Gibbons is applauded for his honesty and promoted to senior management. But what does it really take to climb the rungs of today's corporate ladder? And are the standards different for women? Women make up only 14% of senior corporate leadership in the U.S., and overall, women earn 77 cents to every male dollar. So what's going on? Ashley Milne-Tite of Planet Money reports that, for the corner office at least, it may all start with negotiating a pay raise.
Emily Amanatula is a management professor at the University of Texas, and she became fascinated with the dynamics between men and women pretty early. She grew up with three brothers. She was the only girl in their gang of neighborhood kids. When she went to graduate school, she found a lot of the classic management advice was aimed more at her brothers than herself.
Once you start to learn, especially competitive negotiation tactics, you realize they're pretty at odds with how women generally comport themselves and how they're expected to comport themselves.
Amanatula started to look closely at women's strengths and weaknesses, and they certainly seemed familiar.
To very much a high degree, I am the woman that I study. I don't like to self-promote. I feel uncomfortable in situations where I have to negotiate on my own behalf.
Amanatula wanted to find the source of that squeamishness. She began talking to other women about their experiences at work. Again and again, she heard women say how difficult it was to advocate for themselves at the office. But something else kept coming up. They had no trouble speaking up for colleagues. So Amanatula decided to set up a research experiment. First, men and women had to negotiate a starting salary for themselves. The men did better than the women. Then each of the subjects was asked to negotiate a salary for a friend.
And what we saw was that, on average, women who were negotiating for themselves threw out a counteroffer that was $7,000 less than women who were negotiating for someone else.
Again, when the women were told to negotiate for a friend, they bargained just as hard as the guys.
Women are not bad negotiators. Rather, they're really quite savvy at negotiation.
They just don't always use those skills for themselves. So what's really going on here? There's quite a literature on this. Several studies show when women are direct and assertive during salary negotiations, it puts managers of both genders off. They see the women as pushy and they don't want to work with them. And women know they're expected to be likable. It's a common story. I talked to Miriam Krause. She's an academic. She remembers her first salary negotiation out of graduate school. She was desperate to come across well.
There's the awareness of, I'm going to be working with these people, and you don't want to jeopardize their good opinion of you.
So she picked a number she hoped wouldn't offend anyone, $22,000.
And I got a call from the contract office, and the very nice woman there said something along the lines of, are you sure this is the number that you want? Are you sure you don't want to ask for more than this?
She did end up asking for more, but to this day, she wonders how it can be less painful. So how can women negotiate as successfully for themselves as they do for others? One piece of management advice is basically to remind women they're rarely negotiating just for themselves. They should bear in mind they're often supporting parents or a spouse or their kids. Maggie Neal teaches negotiation at Stanford Business School. When she navigates a new employment package, she thinks of her retired husband, her three dogs, five horses, and 14 chickens.
That's a lot of mouths to feed, and I'm responsible for them.
Essentially, she's asking for more money, not just for herself, but for her spouse and all those animals. Another piece of advice that Neil has is to reframe the whole idea of negotiation.
We really need to think about negotiation in a completely different way. Walk away from this notion of this adversarial, putting on the armor, getting ready to do battle perspective. And rather think about negotiation as problem solving.
Always think, what do you want? What does the company want? And how can you help each other? Here's what it sounds like.
Hello.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. First of all, congratulations on the offer.
This is at NYU's Stern School of Business. Students Jake Singer and Hansini Sharma are learning negotiation skills through role play. In this case, the female recruit is offered a salary of $82,000. Listen to how delicately she counters that.
So I'd like to kind of talk about salary.
Okay.
So I was looking more at like 92, 94, in that range, just knowing what industry standards are. How do you feel about that?
So that's unfortunately a little bit more than we're able to offer you.
But ultimately, Sharma comes away with a slightly higher salary and a lot of the benefits she was angling for. She kept pushing carefully, using language like, would that be possible, or how does that sound?
If you have to rock the boat to get what you think you deserve, then you should do it, but I think there's a right way to do it. You don't have to be rude.
And an interesting thing happens when you learn these skills. Sharma told me she actually likes to negotiate now. Ashley Milne-Tite, NPR News.
When Word of Mouth continues, more stories from the J-O-B front, including a conversation with a man who landed one of those one-in-a-million gigs, sketch artist for the U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us for that story and more Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're having a little Word of Mouth job fair today. Earlier in the program, we heard about salary negotiations in the post-recession era, about life as a freelance copywriter, and now a closer look at an especially rare occupation with Supreme Court sketch artist Arthur Lean. Hello, Art.
Hello.
Is this a dream job for a portrait artist? I mean, how does one enter the business of courtroom sketching in the first place?
Well, I'm not a portrait artist. Let's get that clear to begin with. But it is a kind of a dream job, and I pretty much just fell into it. Our governor in Maryland was going on trial, and I had just graduated from art school, and a local television station was looking for somebody, and that's how I got my start.
So you're normally hired by television stations or maybe newspapers?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time now, and since 1980, I've been under contract with NBC News in Washington, D.C. And recently, I started working for SCOTUS blog as well.
Mm-hmm. So how does one work one's way up to SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, the pinnacle of courtroom dramas, I guess?
Well, actually, it's the first place I went to in D.C.
No kidding.
After that first trial and a couple other hearings in Baltimore, I wrote letters to the three networks. There were only three at the time. And CBS invited me to come and try out. And their artist at the time was a man named Howard Brody, who was a great, great sketch artist. He had been a war correspondent and, you know, sketched World War II and Korea. And he took me around, and he first took me to the Supreme Court, and then later that day to the U.S. Senate, which didn't have cameras at that time.
So how long ago was that?
That would have been in 77, mm-hmm. I believe.
So how about the timeline for turning these around? How quickly are you required to get these images ready for camera?
Well, you know, it used to be you just had nightly news to worry about. Now, of course, there's a 24-hour news cycle. So the joke is you go into the courtroom and take your seat, and before anything even has begun, the producer says, "Do you have anything we can shoot right now?" You know. But I generally need about an hour and a half.
Wow. Sketch artists and stenographers, they were once courtroom staples, right? Now technology has certainly changed things for stenographers. Any notable changes in the way you do your work over the past couple of decades, besides churning it out for not just the nightly news?
Well, you know, I get these questions from young artists wanting to go into the field, mm-hmm. and I always tell them that it's a dying art, which it is. There are far fewer venues. You know, there's cameras in a lot of the courts. The Senate, of course, has cameras. And eventually the Supreme Court will have cameras. So my days are numbered.
Hmm.
There's no stopping technology. And once Google Glasses become popular, I think that's going to be the end of it.
I recently interviewed Justice Sotomayor, who told me that she is really relieved because she was having her makeup done for the stage, and she thought, if I had to do this every day, look the best. Yeah, that would not be something she would be in favor of.
Well, when people ask my opinion about cameras in the Supreme Court, of course, whatever I say, they're going to say, well, this is a guy who, you know, has a financial interest in this.
Mm.
But looking at it from the point of view of one of the justices, I would definitely, you know, think about it twice.
Well, what do you think you get in a sketch made over, you know, several minutes compared to a photograph that just gets one little glimpse and captures one moment in time?
Well, I think the sketch is more like a reporter writing a story. I get to condense things together. And I get to, you know, I have to edit some stuff out of it. So obviously there's a lot I miss, too, because, you know, I'm trying to produce this drawing at the same time that, you know, things are happening in real time.
But obviously you're listening of what's going on, and I'm wondering about the actual decisions being handed down by the court. Do you think your feelings about a case or about somebody who's arguing a case has ever entered your work or has ever sort of influenced your work in any way?
I don't think so. I you know, I do try to capture what I see. You know, if I see a lot of emotion in you know, in a lawyer arguing before the court, I'm going to try and convey that. I really go out of my way not to put my own feelings into it. You know, I'm not going to make this lawyer ugly if I don't agree with his side, you know.
Twisting his mustache.
Right. And, you know, it's enough of a struggle just to try and get a passable likeness, you know, to get a gesture right or the position of, the way somebody holds themselves. It's very hard to listen to what's actually being said, and I don't think I'm as good at that as maybe some of my colleagues. I sort of get in the zone when I'm drawing, and I think my drawings are good because of that, but sometimes I miss what's going on.
We're speaking with Art Lean. He has the extremely rare and, as he says, disappearing job of a Supreme Court sketch artist. Are courtroom sketch artists tight-knit, or is there competition between the artists?
It depends. In Washington, D.C., we're pretty tight-knit. There are really just three of us right now, Dana Verkuterin, Bill Hennessy, and myself. From what I understand, the New York scene is very competitive. There are some artists trying to undercut others. And I think everybody up in New York is freelance. So it's sort of like whoever runs out of the courthouse with the sketches first sometimes gets the job.
I wonder about what's going on for you artistically. You said that you were an art student when you took this up. Is there any part of you that, you know, wants to experiment, wants to play around with things, or do you feel like, well, this is what is expected and this is what I have to deliver?
No, I play around a lot, and I change my media, you know, probably every 10 years or so. Right now, a few years ago, just before the Sandusky trial, I switched over from markers to watercolor, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
So. Oh, watercolor must be really interesting to work with in the courtroom.
It's great. It's great. And pencil. It's just so simple. And, you know, one thing you have to bear in mind is sometimes I get sent out of town, mm-hmm. and you have to use supplies that you can buy in any town, you know. So pencil and watercolor, that's pretty much universal.
So I know you don't only cover Supreme Court cases, but is there a particular justice that you like to sketch?
I would have to say Sotomayor.
Really?
Well, for one thing, she sits closest to the press section, and she also looks over in our direction all the time. Mm-hmm. We've often wondered about that, whether she's just turning her head so that she can hear better. But, you know, she's great to draw, and she's got these big earrings and, you know, bangles, and she's very active in questioning. So I think right now my favorite is Sotomayor.
Wondering about, for you, Art, any particularly memorable cases, you know, that are funny or surprising stories from your career that just stick out for you?
Oh, you know, there probably are. I'm going a little blank right now. I'll say the toughest case I ever covered was the McVeigh trial.
Oh, you did that.
Huh. Yeah, and we did a nightly news story every single night. It was really, really stressful.
I mean, obviously, it was a pretty fraught case, but I'm wondering what made it so difficult out of all of them for you.
You know, the pressure and the testimony was just awful. And it just was sort of unrelenting. And the pace, it actually moved along very quickly. You know, I just found that on the weekends, you know, by Sunday evening, I was just starting to feel normal again. Hmm. You know, what was also strange was, I think, McVeigh, the way each day he would come into the courtroom with a big smile and, you know, sort of like, it just was a very, very strange juxtaposition, seeing the victims there and McVeigh, who just seemed to think that he had done a great thing, you know.
So that's a pretty grim picture. Any trials in particular that stick out for just giving you a lot of hope that justice will be done?
Boy, there haven't been very many of those. I guess, you know, a lot of the abscam trials were pretty amusing.
So you got to draw the guy who in the movie Christian Bale played with a comb over?
You know, I haven't seen that movie yet, but I believe what's his name, Weinberg?
Yes.
I believe I did. Yeah, somewhere I have those sketches, and I need to dig them up.
Well, what an archive you must have.
Well, yeah, I have a huge archive, and I'm in the process of trying to put everything online in an archive. So I have a lot of scanning to do, and hopefully I'll get it done.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Courtroom sketch artist for NBC and also now for SCOTUS blog Art Lean. You can see examples of his work and find a link to his website at wordofmouthradio.org. Sketch artist for the Supreme Court. Nice work if you can get it, and doesn't sound like a job you would want to leave. But what if you got paid to? We wrap up our day's work with the true story of a company that offers employees a hefty sum of money to quit before they have even started. Stacey Vanek Smith reports for Freakonomics Radio.
How much do you like your job? If somebody offered you money to quit, how much would it take for you to do it?
This job is worth more than $1 million, definitely. It's just, I love it here. It's very hard to get in, but once you're in, it's just, it's kind of like the Wizard of Oz. We're in the Emerald City. That's what I feel like.
You're out of the woods, you're out of the dark, you're out of the night.
That's Christina Gomez. And would you believe she's talking about a job that pays just a few bucks above minimum wage? The job is at Zappos, an online shoe store that Amazon paid almost $1 billion for in 2009. At an employee training session in Las Vegas, everybody talked like that. Most of the 35 people in my session were headed to the company's call center, where they'll earn about $11 an hour dealing with customer questions and complaints. But as it trains these new hires, Zappos also throws them a curveball. Here's Marcela Gutierrez, a trainer with Zappos.
Remember how we said that we want this to be more than a job for you guys? We want it to be a career. We want it to be a calling for everybody. I'm here to offer you $3,000 if you decide that this is not the right place for you.
It's known around Zappos as the offer. During training, when these new employees are already being paid, Zappos offers $3,000 to any new hire who wants to walk away from the job. It's been going on for a few years, and it's gotten some press, but secret or no, what is the company thinking? I put that question to company CEO Tony Hsieh, who masterminded the offer.
It's really putting the employee in the position of, do you care more about money or do you care more about this culture and the company? And if they care more about the easy money, then we probably aren't the right fit for them.
Zappos talks about its culture a lot. And Hsieh says that culture is enough to keep people from taking an offer anywhere else or Zappos' offer to leave. And when I say culture, I am not just talking about free soda in the break room and casual Fridays, as I discovered on the company tour with Zappos supervisor Lauren Becker.
So we've entered the main building. We can like officially kick off our real tour.
Everybody's wearing sneakers and T-shirts. There are sign-up sheets for picnics and poker groups. Conference rooms are decorated in outer space and under the sea themes.
It looks like the convergence of like seven different holidays.
It definitely does. You'll see that everybody's desk is decorated different. Their knickknacks are rubber duckies, streamers. It's pretty crazy.
People are so excited to join the crazy, they turn down the free money. Out of the nearly 2,000 people Zappos has trained, the company says only about 30 have ever taken the offer. Christina Gomez is one of those people. Remember her?
It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz. We're in the Emerald City. That's what I feel like.
Turns out, a week after I talked with her, Gomez took the offer. I called her up to ask her what pulled the curtain back.
It was very cult-like, you know. It was a honeymoon period, and then, you know, I started getting comfortable with Zappos, and then I started seeing maybe some of the things that I didn't really like about it. And so we broke up.
Gomez says the offer wasn't the main reason she quit. She says the schedule Zappos gave her didn't work with her childcare and another job she has at Apple. But how big of an incentive is the offer? $3,000 equals 2 months of busting your hump in a call center. The fact almost no one takes it just doesn't make sense. It does, however, make sense to Dan Ariely, a behavioral economist at Duke who studies decision making. He says that easy money is actually not so easy.
The reason that this trick works is that people spend 10 days, they become a part of the family.
Zappos is all about making trainees feel like family. There are happy hours and scavenger hunts and team projects. And after all that, and before you've actually started working, you get the offer. It's a limited time thing. And when it expires, that's when its real power kicks in, says Ariely.
There's something called cognitive dissonance that says that if you've acted in a certain way, over time you're going to overly justify your behavior. So the next morning after you rejected the $3,000, you're going to wake up and say, my goodness, I really must love this company if I rejected this amount.
Translation, we like suffering for things we love. We like it so much that if we suffer for something, we will actually decide we must love it. Ariely says fraternities and sororities work like this when they make rushers stand in the rain or run naked across campus, turning indignity into allegiance. Militaries, sports teams, religious cults all use this tactic too, combining our intense desire to belong with our intense desire to justify our actions. The result? A group of employees who won't even quit if you pay them.
Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith there reporting for Freakonomics Radio. So glad you could join us for our little exploration of life at work today. But it is not over yet. The conversation continues on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, where we pose this question: what is the greatest work freakout scene on film? Here are a few of the responses so far. Peter Finch's iconic scene from Network.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, "I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!"
Edward Norton's self-beating scene from Fight Club.
What the hell are you doing?
And of course, Jerry Maguire.
Who's coming with me?
Did we miss any? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.